I was born in Dublin.
What part?
Dunor Avenue. In the Liberty of the Earl of Meath. The place they all talk about.
Is that in the Liberties now?
It's in
the Liberties district.
Well, of course, there was more than one Liberty, as it were. Like, the Earl of Meath had a Liberty, that is a district over which he had kind of a limited authority. Then the Archbishop had one, and I think there was another one also. So the Liberties, in fact, are a wee bit more than the Coombe and Thomas Street and up to Hurdles Cross. But it was in the Earl of Meads when I was born, on the 1st of April.
What year?
1912.
It's a very famous place, isn't it, for musicians?
I don't know. I'm not claiming it for them.
Well, there seems to have been a myth built up about the Liberties in recent years.
It is purely a myth. I learned the pipes off John Potts, who was living there. Now, John, if I can recollect, it was 1871, I think, was his birth year. And he was born in South Wexford. He was actually working in the town of Wexford before he came to Dublin, before he went into Guinness's. So he was up here, I suppose, about 18, 19 years of age. And he was living there. He was, I suppose, 28 or 29 before he went to... He would have been 29 before he went to the Dublin Pipers Club to learn the pipes. What he played originally was the flute. There's no much point in talking about, if we say, the music of the Liberties when, in fact... John Potts came from Wexford, learned the pipes off Dictus Markey, who came from Meath and was associated with Drogheda and that kind of thing. The Rowsams, of course, were the same. They had come from Wexford, and they would have been in the Liberties also, because that Liberty went back up to Hurdles Cross, up beyond Hurdles Cross Park, came down along Cambrasil Street, back out into Dean Street near St. Patrick's. Who else there? Dan Dowd was. He was born very near me in Marrowbone Lane, at least not he was born on the other side of the river when he was a child. He was reared in Marrowbone Lane. But it is really, I think, a myth, you know, to be talking about the music of the Liberties.
Did you come from a musical background?
In a sense, yes. An uncle of mine reared my father, uncles and that, you see. My grandfather died for a young man, and this Uncle Joe reared them. And when this revival came, we say the Gaelic League, and that, the man went off buying the Irish paper. He wasn't able to pronounce it, but he thought he should buy it anyway, Fonian Lay. And he bought a war pipes for my father, and he bought a set of Indian pipes for another Uncle Joe. They were the ones I inherited, as it were. This was part of the, you know, the new activity, as it were. The man was Irish-minded. My third uncle, James, he bought him a fishing rod. I don't know why it was the war pipes. And my father then was in the Pipers Club a year or two after it started. It started here in Dublin in 1900. He lived at the top of Coombe Street, and the side wall was at the back of Newmarket Police Station. And he said... He was terrified one Sunday. A head arrived over and roared at him to stop playing the pipes, you see. They were just adjoining St. Nicholas without the church on the Coombe, you see. And the minister was giving his sermon, and he sent round word to the police station to get the pipes stopped. He would be finished in 20 minutes, and then whoever was playing, they could play again then, like. But they were trying to listen to the word of God on a Sunday, and Brian Boru's march, I'm sure, very badly played, was on and on and on, you see. So he, my father, and John Potts were very friendly. There were two young men, as it were, working, living near each other and that. And I have a very distinct memory of the big man coming in each Sunday. He'd come in after whatever mass it would be like, and I can remember him sitting down. I can picture where he sat in the kitchen and that. I can't remember him playing, though he actually did play, because the uncle was living at home and the pipes were there. So that afterwards, when I did come to play the pipes myself, which was about 15 years of age, some of the tunes, the minute I heard them again, I knew I had heard them before. Now, the trip to the cottage was one of them, and the maid on the green, and Jackson's morning brush. I heard, when I began to learn them, I realised that I had known them before, as it were, like. What put me on those pipes was there was a family across the road from us in Hammersley Wards that were mixed up in pipe bands and that. And I went across him at Christie, he was in the Fintan Dollars at the time also, and he gave me a practice. Chanter showed me the scale and a few Dublins and this kind of thing, and I got as far as the first two parts of the Barton Rocks of Aden, and what was it, the Earl of Mansfield's March, I could play them. And my lip opened, you see, so I had to give up the practice chanter. An old cousin of mine at home said, "Listen, why don't you get your Uncle Joe's pipes? They have a bellows," she says, "and you don't have to blow into them." You see, I said, "Where are they?" And she told me they were with John Potts, you see. So she told me where John lived, and I went down. He was a fine, fine, big, big man, and there were two steps up to the house, like. And I knocked at the door, and this giant looked down at me. And I said, "I've come for my Uncle Joe's pipes." See, he dumbfounded. He didn't know who I was, what I was at. You see, and then he made out. He said, "You must be a son of Pat's." I said, "Yes." So in, and thereafter, I'm sure for years and nearly every night of the week, I haunted poor Mrs. Potts. As I said before, I don't know how much she must have drunk tons of tea on her, like, for year in, year out. I started actually, as it were, learning. Going really to a teacher, went down to Bill Andrews, he was down in Essex Quay. Then I achieved a practice set, just £4, Leo made it.
Leo Rossum?
Leo Rossum, yeah. It was Basil Bag and that kind of thing. And I think the bellows now are still in existence. Leo made a tremendous, easily moved kind of bellows. The chanter, of course, was the concert pitch, that. And I went down to the Tech, as we called it, down Chatham Road, the Municipal School of Music, or the college, wherever it is now. Leo was there, there'd be Pat Brophy used to go there, Purcell, Leo, was teaching the war pipes at the time, and Leo would be in and out, like, and Dan was there also. And what I used to do, I'd go in and get my lesson off Leo. Leo had a great gift. If you ask him any tune at all, the Books of Wardmore, now, he would never say, "Listen, wait until you're able to play it," or that kind of thing. Just hand him the manuscript and he'd write it out. Now, he'd write it out quicker than you could copy off a book or that kind of thing, and hand it back. I would put it in my pocket, and up then, up on the way home, Potts is between Chatham Road and Old Avenue, and I'd go in there, undoing, I suppose, what I'd learned in the Tech, because John had a different style of piping. He favoured the closer style, and Leo was kind of legato, as it were. This went on for some years. Brother Gildas used to come in August.
Who was Brother Gildas?
Brother Gildas was Patrick O'Shea, his name was. He was a De La Salle brother. He was from Kerry, a native speaker, a traditional singer too. And he learned the pipes of a man called James Burke in Kilfrush, near Knocklong. It was near one of the novitiates of the De La Salle order. Gildas went to him for 5 or 6 years and played exactly, he wouldn't even change a note from the way he had learned it from Burke. Burke had learned the pipes from a man named Fraher, who was alive around the beginning of the last century, around 1800. So that if I learned a tune, Willie Clancy learned also, John Reed, various people learned tunes off Gildas that way. But you might say we were learning them from Gildas, from Burke, from Fraher. So that around the 1930s or that, you were learning a tune that you could really put back to 1800. Fraher must have been born, we say, even in the previous century. Brother Gildas, a beautiful player. He played 16½ Egan set of pipes. He was fanatic after Egan pipes and that. He ended up with a chanter of all dimensions that Egan had ever made, from a wee small little wee thing right down to 18 inches. Beautiful range of chanters he had. what I was contemplating was a national archive of Irish music, that would have songs, Irish, English, the music, and this. Now, there are a whole lot of other kinds of sounds also, we say dialects, classical music, and this kind of thing. And there is, I think, a narrative necessity, we say, of creating an archive of sound. What would strike me about it was that, we say that the National Library, which gives access to the public from 10 in the morning to 10 in the evening, would be a centre for it in a way, that RTE must have a tremendous amount of material of plays, lectures, music, all kinds of things, you see, that there is a tremendous amount of material altogether. And we say with RTE that they certainly have the facilities, that all these things should be put on a national basis, that it shouldn't be, we say, expected of any particular one to do what a whole lot of other people should be involved. All the other organisations up to, we say, 1951, you had the Society for the Preservation and Publication of Irish Music, of which Petrie was the chairman, and there were lords and ladies and dukes and duchesses in charge of it, but it was ineffectual. The Fesh Ciúil was started, and nobody now could believe that the primary purpose for founding the Fesh Ciúil was to save Irish music. There were other efforts from time to time made about saving Irish, but these were all made by people outside. You know, they were in the same situation as the ornithologist is to the bard. But in 1951, when the quota started, it was an entirely different thing altogether. Here you had actually a society of practitioners, as it were. They were kind of a guild. They were all in, you see. And in the first years, there was that kind of a feeling, until I think people began to think about organisation and about rules and regulations, and eventually you ended up that you had people in it who had no knowledge whatsoever at all of Irish music. I can remember sitting down at a national executive meeting. It used to be the Four Courts on Sundays, and there were 24 or 25 people at the thing, various parts of Ireland. There were four people who could have played a jig, and I'm sure there were only the four who would have known the difference between the jig and the reel at it. But they had learned arguments about the 109 clauses they had in the Constitution, this kind of thing.
You once said, Brendan, that it was an organisation with a great future behind it.
Yeah.
What exactly did you mean?
What I
that?
Meant was, here you had, unlike the ones I had mentioned, you know, outside people, preservationists, as it were, you had actually an organisation composed of, like a trade union, or a guild, as it were, that were all practitioners. And in a sense, they possessed themselves already the music of Ireland among their own members, as it were. And in 1951, the tape record was there already. You see? And with little organisation, it struck me at the time, now I'm talking from Dublin at this stage, that you could have sat down, devised a scheme, and got the music of Ireland down on tape, as it were. Now, there's no doubt at all about it that a live performance is the thing, all right, but the next best thing to a live performance is a good recording of it. And a recording of that kind, you can imagine 1951, that's what, 28 years ago. All the musicians who died, think of them. If you had proper recordings of those, you had really historical documents that would be unique. And we had such a store of folk music too that we could have a tremendous collection, far beyond anything possible in any country of Western Europe, say. But instead, they produced a constitution that's as big as the state constitution. It had a book of rules, I think there were about 109 rules in it when I left the thing. And the whole organisation was caught up in whether you should have a branch in London, or whether there should be a province, or whether there should be something or other kind of thing, you know. Should you give more marks for a child who plays on the sea clerk's whistle than a generation, because it's harder to blow a sea, and all this kind of stupidity, and on it went. Now, these are all admirable activities and that kind of thing. I'm not saying these things should be stopped, nor if I talk about traditional music, do I mean that a person with a piano shouldn't play Irish music. All we have to think of it, I spent a good deal of my life learning Irish, and it would never cross my mind to say, unless you're a native speaker, you shouldn't speak Irish. But what I'm saying is that if you belong to an association that is concerned about traditional music played in a traditional manner, you have no business in button accordions, in harps, in mixed instruments. I believe every instrument now is acceptable, according to the rules of the courses, except a guitar, which has sexual symbols associated with, like you see, so since we're saving the soul of Ireland, we couldn't very well have competitions with the guitar. So I'm told, really. The Peabodyian started after a flash hole. We started on 1968, so it must have been a flash hole, a county one or wherever it was, in Milton Malbay. And I can remember the Tuesday morning when the crowd had gone, all the noise subsided and that, and the people were getting order back onto the streets, sweeping it up and this kind of thing. There were four or five of us in Wilson's pub in the morning. Seamus McMahon was there, Martin Talty, Sean Reid, myself. Indeed, there was somebody else there. And somebody passed the remark, wouldn't it be great now if you had a flower which the public weren't at it like? And somebody else, probably Sean Reid, said, no, it wouldn't be better if you only had pipers at it. So I said, that's very easily arranged. I said, you can arrange a weekend quite easily. So from that, Seamus McMahon and myself were left to arrange the weekend. And we looked around various places to see. We hadn't an idea in the world how many would come to it or that. But I forget who put us on to Bettystown, and we decided we'd have the weekend there. The Pipers Club in Thomas Street gave us, I think it was a grant of, well, a loan it was, in fact, of £50, you know, towards the running expenses of it. And we started off, and in the event, 1968 it was, something between 50 and 60 pipers arrived in Bettystown Saturday afternoon, as it were. They came from all over the place, even came from America. The one or two had come from England, but from the length and breadth of Ireland they were there. People were playing and that, and around 9 o'clock, I can still remember, Seamus Ennis took off the coat, folded it neatly, you see, and put on the pipes. Other people had been playing before him, and most impressively tuned them. Was ready to play and just stopped, paused. Now he says, everybody ready with the tape recorders. You see, so the tape recorders were all let go, and Seamus played now inspired altogether. Now, when he had played, a couple of hours, he took off the pipes and he handed them to Willie Clancy, who was sitting beside him. Seeing Willie played a few tunes and took them off, like, you know, and was handing them back. Oh, no, whoever, Lee Moog, I think it was. That's the thing now, would never have happened to any of the old pipers. First of all, if they thought that you could learn the tune, they wouldn't play it. And the idea of handing your pipes to anybody, the excuse was it'd blow them out of tune, which they would, of course. It struck me, you know, I was amazed, because I had been long enough listening to old men talking about what pipers did. One poor man, when the priest had given him extreme unction, he called for the pipes, but it wasn't to play farewell to music or anything at all of that, but he took the reeds out of the chant and the regulators and bit them so that nobody would play them after. Well, this is the kind of, another man wouldn't play, you know, until he sent the wife to the door to make sure there was nobody outside listening. The poor men thought they had something. Like, Seamus had no trade secrets, no nothing. If you asked him what he didn't sing or he commented on, that was a nice little wee turn there. He did it again for you, and it wasn't his fault if you hadn't got it. So, on the Sunday, Sean Reid thought he wouldn't have been able to come, and he wrote a very lengthy letter to be read out. So he did, in fact, manage to be there. And when we had eaten the luncheon, that we had a meeting of all the 54 pipers. And Sean read out his letter, saying that we mustn't part now until we had formed an association of our own. Leo Rousham loudly applauded that. That was a great idea. Seamus Ennis decided it should be the Peabody Alien was the name of it. Like, we'd got that far. And then we're kind of beginning to get arguments then, you know, constituent assembly of 54 pipers. So I stood up and I said, I think certainly everybody was going to start an organisation with the pipers. That was agreed. But I thought that the quickest way of deciding what the rules and regulations should be was to appoint three or four people, to get them down on paper, to circulate them to everybody, or people present and not present, and to have another meeting, we say in October, I said. And that's what we did. Now, I had, as you know, I was assistant secretary of Cotus at the time, and I had experience of all this arguing and bickering and about what rules meant and what it didn't mean and all this kind of nonsense. So I decided that the constitution of the pipers was going to
be right,
be within a quarto page. And in fact, there are, I think, 294 words in it. Right from the outset, we restricted it to practitioners. You had to be a piper. Now, good, bad, and different, it didn't matter. So that...
As long as you played.
So long as you played, or begin learning the scale. You hadn't even to be able to play the bottom D, like. But you were launched. The organisation grew. I had, before that, in my own, like, collecting that, I had come across the cylinders that O'Neill had sent from Chicago to Father Hennebrey, 1908. That's over 70 years ago now. He had got Patsy Toohey and other people to play and sent them over for a Christmas box. There's a reference in Irish folk music, O'Neill's book, you see, and it crossed my mind that Hennebrey had ended up professor of Irish in Cork College. And I asked a friend of mine who had connections with the college, and he took up the phone and phoned, and half an hour it was established. There were cylinders there, all right. And they did turn out, in fact, to be those particular cylinders. You might recollect the amusing one about the... He was writing about Patsy Toohey playing the Shaskeen reel. That was the superior limit of Irish piping. And he declared it was a greater human achievement than the building of Brooklyn Bridge or the writing of the Homeric ballads. And that was among the cylinders there. So that you can read O'Neill, you can play the Shaskeen and decide how good or Patsy Toohey was, and then you can also decide how extravagant Father Hennebrey was in his language. We have upwards now in the pipers of 300 members. We have, I think, 190 here in Ireland. There are 5 in Australia. There are 33, I think, in the States. And we have Sweden, Denmark, Holland, France, Germany. We've nobody in Italy, unless he's roaming around unattached. Nobody Eastern Europe. We have people in Alaska, though. So from Alaska right down to Perth in Australia, we have members. Be unkind to say that I don't listen to it, would it? Really, I think that what Sean did was he made it popular, that he gained an acceptance for it that wouldn't otherwise have been gained. But he said, like a whole lot of other people, more than his prayers when it came to being non-European, non-harmonic, nonsense. So, you know, that's, I think... there's no point in that kind of thing. And there was a lot of nonsense spoken about Carlin and what he did to bridge two civilizations. In fact, you know, it struck me as very light-hearted that nothing of Carlin survived in traditional music. You've never heard anybody play Anthony. I mean, the concerto comes out of O'Neill's book. No bits and pieces of his verse ever survived either in Irish, like, you see, so that he's a romantic figure, but when you've said that, you said it all, I think. On the Ceoltóirí Chúlainn, I didn't really see very much difference between it and the Kilfenora Cayley Band, except I thought the Kilfenora Cayley Band had a better lift in their music. You know, that when you had knocked the piano and knocked the drums and knocked everything else, you suddenly were confronted with the harpsichord, bones and fellas roaring at the top of their voices. In fact, I'm kind of doubtful about there being any future at all for Irish music. The music had a function, we say, in rural Ireland, didn't matter, even in small towns and that up to 70, 80 years ago, when it was played for dancing. And when dancing stopped, as it did finally, we say, around 1940 or that kind of thing, there was no reason for playing music except that some people liked to play it and some people liked to listen to it, kind of thing. Now, without a function, I don't know that it's going to survive. And I think over the last 5 years, I think we have reached the peak of that kind of audience. I have a feeling that the people now willing to listen to the music are getting scarcer.
Would you think that because of the boom in traditional music over the last, say, in particular the last 10 years, that it has been a bad thing overall because it's gone through a fierce commercial upheaval and it's been exploited?
That is so, but when the boom subsides, they depart, as it were, like. And I think the effect of it will be that there will be slightly more people interested in Irish music than there were before the boom started. You know, there will be a residue, as it were, will stick to it. But I think mostly all the huge audiences there was for Irish music will they'll turn their attention to something else. People who play other than pipes can follow whatever is curtained, we say, if it's some other kind of music or that. A piper is stuck to what's playable on the pipes, as it were, and I think there that the pipes are liable to last in this way, that they are, as I said before, a peculiar kind of an instrument, and you can make a kind of a fascinating hobby about it. They're difficult enough to get you to spend a whole lot of time at them, and there is a tremendous body of music also. But I can't there, which might answer your question, I can't there imagine pipers getting tired of the books of Warden Wart, say, and demanding something new. I can't imagine anything new being better than the books of Warden Wart anyway. Like. Yeah, I went into Pickett's. I can remember the man's name, Tobin was his name, and I asked him about their... were they interested in publishing collections of Irish music? Indeed they were. And then he broke the news that they would, if I paid for the printing. I came out, crossed the road, and bumped into a friend of mine. I had been working with him when I went into the civil service first, Sean McGardle. He was high up, say, in the Department of Education at the time. In fact, he was on his way round to the Dáil. So we were picking up the thread since the last meeting. You know, how are you, and this kind of thing, and we sit at the pipe. So I overed the encounter with Pickett's. So he looked at me, he said, could you write something about the music as well? I said, yeah, of course. So he said, I'll phone you tomorrow. And he phoned me the next day. He had been in touch with the Goon. And if I wrote something in Irish, we say, about the music, it would be reading matter in Irish, and the music would be an adjunct to it. And I thought then that I should add to it to make a kind of a sizable book about it. Went around, Tommy Potts, of course. Tommy and myself were more or less the same age, so I got music from Tommy, from Teresa. Tommy Reck was around. Then I went to the St. Mary's Club in
Church Street.
John Egan was there. Got music from John. There was John Brennan, met Sonny Brogan. I could have filled a book from Sonny. Sonny was able to call out the tunes. He was standing at the counter and he called them out. And if you were playing pipes that weren't in tune with the box, he could transpose in his head kind of thing for you. Like, I got a tremendous amount of music from Sonny and from Ned Staple and that. So... shortly, we say, I had a collection of this thing. I had written the first chapter of a book on Irish music in Irish, and sent it into the department, and months and months and months went by, I heard nothing at all about it. They had sent it out to some reader for his opinion, and it hadn't come back. So I phoned my friend, and there was very quick action. And I met the person in charge of the GOOM at the time, and there was a kind of a suggestion, kind of tentatively put to me, would I mind, instead of writing, we say, 12 chapters that I proposed, would I mind, as it were, reducing it to about, well, 1,000 words? So, of course, I didn't mind reducing it. So what, in effect, was it was going to be a book of music with an introduction rather than a book about music with an appendix of music in it, like it. And in the end, anyway, the book was kind of finished, 214 tunes, and then it went to the department. So the show rink, as it were, represented the current music of the time, 1958, 1956, 1957, 1958 kind of thing.